Hi, today is July 30th, 2023. This is Movies Podcast 468. I'm Todd Agassi-Ward, my good friend, the good Dr. John Westfall.
Try to beat.
Yep. We might. Oh, and this is exciting. Got a package delivery in the middle or the beginning of the podcast.
Ah.
So.
Well, that is modern day Christmas, you know.
It is.
For kids, Christmas was only once a year. Now it's whenever.
Yeah. So this one, you know, I usually blame you for stuff that I buy.
Yes.
But today I will not blame you. Today I will blame our good friend Sven Johansson. And actually, this is a good thing because I am, you know, one of the things that happens when you retire is you get a lot poorer in terms of your monthly income. And I am paying my landline company, let's see, it's over $50 a month. It's like $55. So what's that work out to? $660 a year for a landline that I rarely use. Now, having worked for the telephone company for years, my rationale was, well, you know, during an emergency, one of the things we always told people is, you know, cell phones will go down. This is true because cell tower batteries die and all kinds of stuff. But your landline should remain up and running. And this is generally speaking true. But when you're old, you say, well, you know, I'm not going to live forever anyway. So who cares? So if I can save anyway. So I spent about $90 on this thing that Sven recommended called the UMA. We have slightly different models. I think he has the LTE model that works off of T-Mobile Unlimited or something. And I bought the UMA Telio Air 2, which is a Wi-Fi Ethernet model, because I'm just going to use my existing broadband provider, who is not my wireline provider. And it was, I think, $90 on Amazon. So it's pretty reasonable. If you're on the if you're in the lower 48, as people in Alaska call you guys, if you're in the lower 48, you can get quite a deal because I think you only pay for taxes to get a landline. And like, you know, so $5 to $10 a month. And you can do your number porting for, I don't know, $30, $40 one time and you're done. But if you're not in the lower 48, or if you're in Alaska or Hawaii where I am, or Puerto Rico, then if you want to do one number portability, you got to pay, I think, annually for that privilege. Because, you know, we're not like Americans or something. Not sure. But it's still worth it. So $90. And I think I can get it. Well, you don't exactly get it for free. But if you buy into UMA's premier plan, which is about $100 a year, which has a lot of nice features, including, you know, spam blocking and things that landlines generally don't do well. So my total cost of ownership will be it'll be $100 a year, plus the initial $90 hardware thing. And I guess I need to replace this every couple of years. So, you know, let's call it $30 a year for the sake of argument. Mm-hmm. It's about $130 a year, which, you know, if I'm paying $550, I'm still coming out ahead, you know, net $400 reduction in cost. So I'm looking forward to it. But in the meantime, I have to keep my landline because, you know, the phone company doesn't want you to leave. And so it's going to be months before I can, once I set this up and request a number porting, it's not going to be instantaneous. So hopefully that'll all go well. And by before the end of the calendar year, I will not have to pay my landline provider.
And I am at that unique age at 40 that I actually have never had a landline.
I believe it.
Cell phone. I moved out of home and never had a need for a landline and never decided to get a landline. Ironically, I played around for a while with voice over IP phones. And so I had a lab set up at home where I had what looked like landlines.
Right.
But it was all voice over IP. And occasionally I would actually hook up an actual telephone number trunk to it. But I never used it for anything more than just testing and for a while, it was fun to be able to page random rooms in my house and such.
Right. What's the saying? I dropped the lead, as journalists would say.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead is that, well, why are you keeping your landline at all, Todd, if you have a cell phone, right? And that's one of the questions. And the question is, I'm freaking lazy. And so even though very few people call me on the landline, in fact, very few people call me, period, my landline number is associated with a lot of verifications. You know, for various companies, I forget about until I need to do something with them. Like I had to call AAA the other day because I had something happened to my car. It wasn't traumatic. It turned out to be a $5 part, by the way, that snapped. Although the labor is $300 something. But that aside, you know, it could have been worse. And I needed to use my landline number as a verification, even though I was out on the road. I was sitting in a supermarket parking lot. And so, and I said, gee, I forgot about that one. And so I'm going to keep my landline or my landline number just to be able to not worry about, oh my gosh, did I forget to change my verification number on this, that, and other thing. You know, and as you get old, you have a lot of this, that's another thing. So that is why that is happening. And I'm kind of looking forward. You know, one thing I forgot to buy a phone for it to plug into it. And I don't have any spares, I think. Or if I do, I don't know where they are at the moment. But I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out. So, you know, because I have to keep my other phone plugged in to the, you know, the incumbent until I can move off it. But at any rate, that's the reason I'm old and lazy. And I just don't want to go through the process of being 100% sure I've moved through all of my verification numbers. Anyway, so the moment just arrived. I just unboxed because, you know, I don't do it on video. And I'm very much looking forward to plugging into it and start the process of porting my number and start the process of saving about $400 a year. Or not saving, but I guess you can call it saving. Cost reduction, as we called it when I was.
One of the things that I always remind people of is a thing I did years ago where I sent them a spreadsheet that I call the Master Bills and Subscriptions spreadsheet. I update it every 4 or 5 months just to make sure I've got everything in there so that when I move, I have one place to change phone numbers and addresses and all of that. So if you find yourself moving anytime, you know, that's the best time to set one of these up if you've never set it up for yourself. But having one is very useful.
Yeah, the last time I moved was almost 30 years ago, so it's not something I've done a lot recently. Let me ask you this, John. So you lived in a couple of parts of the lower 48. Did you keep your original cell phone number, or have you switched cell phone numbers to local area codes as you moved?
I have never switched to local area codes.
Okay.
So, both of my area codes are from where I was 24 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, because that's what I've been finding is because, you know, in Hawaii, we only have one area code for the whole state. Is that true? Let me think. Yes, it's true. It's 808. And because we're, you know, we don't have a lot of people, right? We have like 1.3 million people or something. So we have one area code and I know people who have moved to Hawaii, who have lived here and then got a cell phone in the mainland in college or whatever and moved back, and they've kept their, you know, mainland area code. So if in the old days when you had to dial from a landline, you'd have to call long distance, either to the person who may be down the street or something, but which would add costs. Of course, these days, nobody really cares anymore because hardly anybody pays long distance because hardly anybody has landlines.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a whole nother story. But at any rate, I have digressed far too long.
Well, it is interesting. Most of the people that I know do not change when they move to a new area.
Yeah.
So it is fun to kind of see where were people originally from.
Right.
And that is what I've taken away from when people give me their cell phone number. It's, oh, well, you must have gotten that. You get that in high school, you get that in grad school.
Right. Which reminds me, in grad school, the phone company, which was the same one as in Hawaii, or at least in Santa Barbara, used to be GTE. The phone company had student discounts for landlines. And so I remember I stood in line and got my, you know, my little landline number and my telephone. I think I paid $6.25 a month, which if I still pay that amount, I wouldn't bother to switch, but at 55, you know, it's anyway, the good old days. Okay.
Well, and that's how they got you, you know. That's how they made you a landline lover. getting a rod. Okay. First one's not first one's, you know, cheap.
Cheap. And that was a good deal for, you know, for poor students. And I appreciated it. I even worked for the company for a while. Okay. But speaking of today, and, you know, the thing everybody talks about, ChatGPT. So ChatGPT for Android was released about a week ago, I think. But and I know you're not an Android user, John, but I'm just trying to bounce an idea because I don't have an answer for this. So why use ChatGPT and the ChatGPT app for either iOS or Android when you can use Bing, which is based on...
You know, I really don't know. I've been wondering that myself because it certainly seems like it is easier to just use Bing and use Bing AI, I guess is the formal name of it, because it's not chat, it's Bing AI.
Yeah, or Bing Copilot. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought makes the most sense. But I guess people are used to calling it ChatGPT. Most of the time that I talk to people, they will refer to it as ChatGPT, even if it is not ChatGPT.
True.
Like I Kleenex. Will say this week I was grading research papers, and of course, the software that we use for plagiarism checking now detects AI, which is kind of interesting because you can see where students are trying to slip it in and hope nobody notices.
All right.
But the other thing about that is I actually was writing up a blog post that eventually I'll publish that's kind of my pet to use of student writing. More I'm going to publish it so that my students have something to look at before they turn in a paper, and also I'll just put it out there for anyone who's curious about what college writing looks like, good or bad. And one of the things I did was I asked ChatGPT, or I actually asked Bing AI, to create an outline for a prompt. And the prompt I had was something like, write a paper, an outline for a paper on why humans and cats have a symbiotic relationship.
Okay.
And it gave me an outline that, honestly, if a student had written a paper on that outline,
yeah,
had gone through and found good sources and used that as their outline, it would have been an A paper.
No kidding.
No problem at all. The outline was really interesting in what it was going off of. I'm sure I could have worked with it for more than one prompt and gotten more information and things like that. So these tools, if you use them, quote unquote, appropriately in a sense, are going to be very useful. But we have to, I think there's a lot of work to be done that I'm going to start this year with my students to basically say, this is the effective way to get A's with ChatGPT or Bing AI.
Right.
And here's the ways that are going to result in C's, D's, or F's.
Right.
And you take your pick.
Right. And, you know, that's a good thing, because it's sort of like asking a very smart friend for, you know, or a grad, a TA for help, and maybe they give you some hints, and you take that outline of hints and go away, and that's fine, but outright plagiarism is probably not a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's just it exactly. If you know what you're doing with it, then you can use it for some really good purposes and some really good ways of going. But I don't know why anyone would use ChatGPT when they use Bing. When Microsoft was the biggest investor in OpenAI or one of the biggest. So you're really not getting anything different.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, that's the other thing, by the way, is you're thinking, well, Todd, you can use ChatGPT 4.0. And I would say, yes, you can if you pay money for it. Because you need to pay for access to 4.0. You can do 3.5 for free. But if you want the fancy-dancy stuff, you know, you got to pay a monthly fee. Bing is still free, as far as I can figure out. I mean, it doesn't require you to have Office 365 or Microsoft 365 subscription or anything, I think. Just a Microsoft account. Any rate. Speaking of Copilot, you're using it for something interesting, or you've noticed something interesting.
Yeah, so earlier this week, I was playing around with Power Automate, which used to be, I forget what my son used to call it. I've already forgotten. It's been Power Automate for a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that I had a Bing or a Copilot ability in it. So I gave it a prompt, which was... the exact quote was, I want to take a Microsoft Forms input and place it inside fields in a Word document.
Oh, okay.
And it, in about 5 seconds, had the three building blocks that I needed, one of which I didn't even know existed that you could use in that way. And aside from a weird hiccup where I found that to put in metadata fields for a Word template, you need to use Word on Windows and not Word on a Mac, even though right. it looks exactly the same. I had a proof of concept up running in, I guess, about 5-10 minutes. And I said to some collaborators, I said, hey, I got it working. And they said, oh, I want to come see it. I said, well, literally right now, all it does is take this one question on your form and you know, answer it to this one field in a Word template. It's very underwhelming right now. It means that we can set up what we basically want to do is have people fill out a form. It would then take all those form responses, put them into a Word document, nicely formatted, and then spit out that Word document so that the individuals and their collaborators can edit it, you know, back and forth. So make sure everyone starts with everything in the same place, and then you can go from there. So I'm pretty excited by that. And it was interesting to me because not only was it very quick, I was talking with a friend who's a developer, and he and I were talking about how I said, you know, I've abandoned a lot of development projects in the past because I haven't wanted to set them up.
Right.
You know, even if I have the IDE set up and ready to go and I know what I need to do to get the files to where they need to be and all those things. And even sometimes now with some of the Flutter apps that I've been playing with, you still have this issue of got to run the command and then edit the API code, all that kind of stuff. It just makes it annoying to have to.
I hear you.
So I'm wondering if the future of AI for coders is just do all the boring stuff and let me jump right in and have fun. You know, give me to a working model of this application and then I'll fill in the cool stuff I want to do with it. But you've done all the heavy lifting of putting the buttons in the right place and linking the pages together and,
right.
you know, declaring the variables needed and all those sorts of
things. Right. So the next step beyond what we used to be called visual programming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question. I think you're right, personally. That's the way it's going to happen. It's the way it's happening. I think a lot of coders are actually doing a lot with
mm-hmm.
Copilot and other kinds of, or, you know, Bard or whatever, to get them past sort of the grunt work. It reminds me, though, you know, it's not going to eliminate programmers because programmers still have value in things. 30 years ago, when I was working on advanced intelligent network stuff for the phone company, the big deal is we had visual literal blocks, you know, you drag and drop blocks onto a screen and you design phone services for the central offices. Well, actually for the service nodes that control the central offices, which gave it the intelligence. And everybody said, well, you know, we're not going to need programmers for this, that, and other thing anymore because we can just have, you know, clerical staff or somebody design these services for customers and it'll be fine and dandy. But it turned out that, you know, programmers do have a skill. And that skill is, you know, knowing how to debug and knowing how to look at optimization and knowing how to organize. And one of the other things that turned out was, and this is going to be a problem in enterprises, people use Copilot and other kinds of AI tools to generate, you know, applications willy-nilly, is you're not going to have an enterprise of, say, you know, I don't know how large university is, but let's say you have thousands of faculty members, or let's say 1,000 faculty members, just for our sake of argument, who used to not develop anything, most of whom did not develop anything, or if they did, it was very few. And now anybody can develop anything, and you're going to have this flood of applications that nobody knows how to maintain, or maybe even where it is that needs to be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
yeah, that is something. That's something that our university has started to talk a little bit about, because, of course, create a Microsoft Power Automate flow, and I
need
my account, all those things. My account gets disabled because I leave. Well, all of a sudden, things that I worked on are broken.
Right, exactly.
And I take care. Think about it in that way to make sure that I share out my Power Automates to a team, or, you know, if the team is the owner or any of those things, so that my account isn't the one that's the linchpin and all of it. But I still am planning, if I ever leave my institution, to basically tell the IT department, look, you might not want to axe my account immediately. you might want to just change my password and leave it running and monitor him, because there are going to be things that it will potentially be doing that will break across the institution that I have forgotten about that have been up and running for years.
Right. Right. And we've had, you know, we've got lots of stuff. Like one of the things that I was unsuccessful in before I retired was what I called the seek and destroy all Microsoft Access databases. Which, you know, they're perfectly functional. Well, maybe perfectly is an operative word. They're functional, but they were kind of, you know, errors waiting to happen, so to speak.
Yes.
And I, as I said, I was unsuccessful. One of the things that there was a, what was it called? I forget. There is a power something that basically lets you develop, you know, databases easily, kind of like Access, but, you know, without all the danger. And so, well, at any rate, that was my one of my failures before I retired.
Access in the era of FoxDB and stuff like that, where there was a lot of poorly designed yet functional software that came out of that era.
Oh,
is still around. It's debatable how, but it works. And sometimes, you know, works is better than nothing, even if it's not great works.
Right. Let's see. Well, it's not going to work. I was just trying to do something, but that did not fix it. All righty. So, yeah, very cool. I was just going to go check if I didn't go check to see if I think I have Power Automate in my personal account too, but I haven't really played it though.
Have a personal level too.
But I don't know if Copilot for a Power Automate is available. I don't think so.
That's a good question. I will bring it up. I'll try to log in personal account Power Automate and I'll see.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Next up, I know John's not a Android user, although he has used Android and stuff. But I just found this interesting because, you know, I bought the Pixel tablet a month or two ago. And just last week, in the Google's Android developers blog, they had a entry called "Introducing a New Play Store for Large Screens." So they're actually going to have an area of a Play Store that focuses on the Pixel Fold, which they consider a large screen, and the Pixel Tablet, and other devices like that. And it says, today we're introducing 4 major updates to help users find high-quality large-screen apps on Play. Refreshed app listings, ranking, and quality improvements. Oops, and I just lost Chrome. Oh, no, macOS just decided to give me some stuff. Streamlined store navigation and split-screen search experience. So that's good, because, you know, one of the problems with Android tablets is the apps that are... there are few and far between. And as anybody in the early days of the iPad remembers, using an iPhone, rescaled iPhone app on an iPad was not a happy solution. It was, you know, it was a solution. It wasn't a good one. And it's the same problem with Google tablets. So I'm looking forward to seeing more tablet-designed apps for my Pixel tablet, which I've come to appreciate over the weeks I've been using it. And then it goes in the next one is there's another blog that just came out a couple days after that on July 27th from Google's blog, say about 6 creativity apps for Android tablets. So that was kind of interesting too. There weren't very many, you know, and I've tried a couple of them. But it's a good thing because I think if we see a healthy Android tablet ecosphere, then we'll see an even healthier iPad ecosphere. And I think the iPad's got a pretty good one. But it is getting a little long in the tooth some days. It's like, you know.
there are things that could definitely improve. Android in the past, I've written a book that has the word Android in the title. So I definitely am not an Android dislike person. I actually think that Windows is good for Android, is good for iOS. There's some wireless for Android because it creates a situation where people say, I want to have that or I want to, you know, have that particular ability on my platform, and it creates a need in the market. It is interesting, though, to me. I was talking with my wife yesterday about the rumors of Apple potentially buying Disney, which have been circulating around forever. And I, you know, Apple and Disney both share an interesting corporate culture where they want people to actively form emotional connections to their content, mm-hmm. their devices, their software, their services, whatever.
Right.
And that's the language they use around it. And you compare and contrast that to Google, Microsoft, and most of the film studios out there where they just want you to get the
money.
Bang for your buck. Yeah, pay us money and we will give you an action film. You will not care about the characters that much afterward. You will see action and explosions, blah, blah, blah. Pay us money, we will give you a phone that does phone things. Pay us money, we'll give you a service that, you know, manages this or that. And so it is interesting to me that there's these two ways of going about inspiring people to have loyalty. And one is build an emotional bridge and exploit that, and the other is, you know, the functional bridge and exploit that. And it's debatable, you know, I think Apple gets dinged for functionality sometimes, and Google gets dinged for ease of use and pleasure of use and enjoyability. I've never met anyone who is deeply in love with the Android operating system, but I've met plenty of people that you can't grab their iPhone from them until you pry it from their cold, dead hands. So... but at the same time, I've never met anyone that looks at an iPhone and goes, look at the value I got on this thing. It was, you know, that's exactly what I needed. It was cheap. But that's what Android users will go for. So I guess it's just interesting to me psychologically how you build that connection for someone.
As I said, Andrew, I'm just hopeful that I'll see a more valuable Android tablet experience soon. I think it's already pretty valuable. It's just that, you know, some things just aren't there on it yet or are just a little flaky. I will mention one thing before we get to our next topic, is that Concepts, one of the six creativity apps might have been. Concepts is also available for iPad, by the way. It's kind of like Freeform, actually. It's a, you know, drawing, note-taking app. And I was just fussing with it last night, now that I have a functional stylus up, an Oval USI 2.0 stylus. And I was thinking, you know, this is a pretty good experience. This, you know, I don't want to pay a monthly fee for it because I don't, you know, I just don't do notes the way I used to in the old days. It's not worth it. But for the free side of it, did what I wanted to do for testing, and I'm pretty happy with it. Gets us to the next and I think the last topic, and that is Apple Freeform. So we're like not quite a year from its, you know, availability to the general public like us. And I don't know where we are.
Yeah. And we talked about this a little bit over the last couple of weeks. And
yeah,
it's a weird world with Freeform. I have opened up Freeform two or three times with the ambition to do something with it. And then immediately gone, nope, this is not the tool for this task.
Yeah.
And it's never the tool that I think, it's not like I'm always saying, oh, Freeform isn't the tool, X is the tool, and I'm going over to X, not the new Twitter, but, you know, X is in a very...
Right.
It's always that Freeform isn't the tool, but maybe it's Y, or maybe it's Z, or maybe it's A, or maybe it's B.
Right.
It's like, Freeform gets me thinking about, what am I really trying to do here, and then
right.
I know a better tool. So like I said, the only way I could see Freeform being a useful tool is if I can at least share the web view of it, and then you and I could collaborate, and we share it with, you know, we could put it as an embed in the podcast feed or whatever, but it's just not feasible, Apple, that everyone I know is going to have an Apple device to view my Freeform rambles.
Yeah, I hear you. It's funny because, as you might recall, I was really excited about Freeform prior to its availability.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had been trying to use Microsoft Whiteboard in the enterprise in a similar way, and I couldn't get traction there either. You know, so I would use it for meetings, and I would present things to people and provide them with notes and Whiteboard, and they would thank me for it because, you know, this is really useful, but they themselves would never use it.
Well, that's because it was half broken all the time.
Microsoft
Whiteboard was the weirdest. It was almost like QA team just didn't show up for work. So you would
you'd start doing something and it would be working fine, and then it would glitch, and then you'd have links that didn't work, or you'd have whiteboards that didn't save, or web views that didn't update. And yeah, it was just, that was the weirdest thing.
It was like,
I tried using it in class for a while, because what I would do is I would bring up the whiteboard on my tablet and then bring up the web view of it on the projector. And then I could draw on the tablet, and sometimes it would update on the projector. Other times it would not. Sometimes I could share it out later. Sometimes I could not. It was a very frustrating experience, because if it had just worked as it was advertised, and if it had been in the consumer the environment, not always education or business environments, that would have been better too. But yeah, again, another product that Microsoft had an advantage on creating before Apple, and then they just dropped it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like tablets and phones and a bunch of other things. But at any rate, so I am still trying to find a purpose for. I still like the idea of Freeform. I don't know why. It just appeals to me. But I don't, you know, it's a solution in search of a problem, and I don't know what the problem it solves is yet. It is the most bizarre thing. So, well, let me know if you think of anything.
With it not having some of the integrations that I would want it to have,
yeah,
I just don't think it has much of a problem solution ability right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Meta's Threads, you know, which is actually an attractive little service, microblogging service, as people used to say. But without a web interface, it's not as useful as it could be. Not as interesting as it could be. By the way, before we sign off, I want to apologize. There have been times when John has been Cyloning, if for people who remember Battlestar. I do not think it's John's fault. I think that's my fault. Because when I woke up this morning, I thought, hey, I have not used my MacBook Pro in a couple of weeks. I should boot it up and update Mac OS to whatever the current version is. It got a recent update. And so I did that, or you know, like a couple hours ago after I got up. What I didn't realize is it was still re-indexing. And you know how Mac does its performance and enhancements right after you upgrade it. And I didn't realize it would take like hours. So I think what was happening was during the podcast, the Mac would like start indexing something. And I think John would start Cyloning at that point. And anyway, my apologies. I think the problem was based on me, not John. Even though he took the brunt of the audio hit. And for those who do not know what a Cylon is, it is spelled C-Y-L-O-N. Look it up in association with Battlestar Galactica. Both versions had Cylons. Is that true? Yes, both versions had Cylons. And, you know, you can argue which one was better. Most people think the reboot was better, but that is an opinion that you may not agree with. All righty. Well, that's about it. Thanks, as usual, to the good doctor for joining me for another podcast, and we will talk to you next time. Thank you, John.